This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
One of the starting places, I could have chosen some others, but few are more strange and engaging than the demon Asmodeus, who appears in a 1707 novel, Le Diable Boiteux, the Devil on Sticks, by Alain-René Lesage. And in this story, Asmodeus is released from some wizard's captivity by a student who accidentally crashes through this wizard's tower and releases the demon. And the demon, in gratitude, takes the student up to the rooftops of Madrid and waves his hand, and the rooftops of the city disappear, and the student, Don Cleofas, is able to peer down into all of the buildings below, and even more than into the structures of the city, into the unconscious lives and the dreams of the denizens of the city. And I think this just grabbed me because it was such a powerful sort of fantasia about omniscient narration, in a way, right? About this fantasy that you could kind of go anywhere and have access to any interior or even interiority. But it sort of lay fallow. I didn't know what to do with it, in part because others had written really compellingly about the itinerary of this book in 19th century realist fiction. So in a couple of places in Dickens's work, but also in Hawthorne, in a story called A Case of Identity by Conan Doyle, even in Carlyle's work, this spirit is invoked. And in Dickens's case, he imagines a certain shadow which may go into any place, a kind of semi-omniscient, omnipresent, intangible creature. I want him to issue his warnings from time to time, and to loom as a fanciful thing all over London, a sort of previously unthought of power going about. So this idea of a kind of beneficent trespass is, in a way, Dickens's way of describing what omniscient narration does. And people had written, people had written about this as a figure for public health, for new regimes of kind of penetrating populations, surveilling populations. And I remained interested, but again, was sort of crashing around with other projects, just collecting materials, wanting ways to think about what it means to look out and see a totality, or imagine that you can see a totality, and what motivates that fantasia, and also what impedes it. Became interested in a kind of visual culture analog to this fantasy of the perfect look-down view, in learning about early aerial photography, which starts in the mid-19th century. This guy on the left is the first aerial photographer in Paris, Félix Nadar, better known as a portrait photographer. This is his self-portrait in a fake balloon gondola. But this is one of his very first photos of, I think, right near the Arc de Triomphe, right? Maybe? It's a little hard to tell. But anyway, it's a balloon photograph of Paris. And he became a celebrity through this. So I began to think about the fact that in the 19th century and going into the 20th, human beings actually had a new kind of vantage of especially urban collectivities, a new way of seeing and thinking about the layout of the built environment and the way that it enabled people to cross paths with strangers and produce meaning through their ways of cutting paths through the city. This is a photograph from a kite of San Francisco after the 1906 earthquake and fire. You can't see, but it's a kite being flown from the deck of a battleship. Still collecting materials. This is a photograph taken by a brief experimental form of aerial photography, pigeon cameras. Don't know if you can see that very well. But this, I mean, the risk was that this would become a kind of crazy hobbyist project, right? Something that I would do in my basement next to the train set. Not that there's anything wrong with train sets. I'm fond of them. But it started to sort of connect with things that I was teaching when I began to think about the ways that cities in the 20th century are not only perceivable in new ways, but also destroyable in new ways because they can be seen, or because of changes in destructive technologies. So these two photographs pertain to a writer who's really important to me, Joyce. And in 1915, Joyce was living in Trieste with his family, and the city was being bombed by Italian airplanes. And they were one of the reasons that he and his family eventually left for Trieste, because he had a terror of bombing, understandably enough, and wanted to move to a neutral place. But around this time, he's also reading about anti-colonial efforts in Dublin, which culminate in the Easter 1916 rising. And it's while he's working on Ulysses in Zurich, in neutral Zurich, during the war, that he tells a good friend of his that he wanted to give a picture of Dublin so complete that if the real city suddenly disappeared from the earth, it could be reconstructed from my book. And this is a sentence that a lot of Joyce scholars quote, mostly without really believing it, but just as a kind of example of the way Joyce used to boast about his memory of his hometown or about his ability to render detail. But I think a growing number of folks who think about this book realize that cities actually do disappear in the 20th century with a new kind of rapidity and severity, and that maybe the premise of this boast is actually worth taking kind of seriously, right? Particularly given that, as again, as I was saying, Joyce, as he's working on Ulysses, is reading newspaper reports of the shelling of Dublin nearly level and of people saying that it looks just like the towns of the First World War near the front that are being obliterated in that effort. We also, I think, want to think about connections between colonial violence here and violence in the European metropole, or at least in European towns near the front, and I'll have a little bit more to say about that in a second. I think it was when I started seeing images, though, of the cities that were bombed with incendiaries in the Second World War, unroofed by firebombing, both by the Allied forces in Germany and in Japan, and by the Axis powers, that I began to think that there's a connection to be made between that 19th century fantasy of omniscient narration and overview and penetrating the interiors of cities, and what happens, probably not a straight line to connect them, but some way of trying to think them together. And that's when I started to think about temporality more. I had been reading about trauma studies as a result of having been in the orbit of Dominic Lacapra at Cornell, where it was sort of all trauma studies all the time. And as you know, if you've read in trauma studies, and even if you haven't spent time in that academic field, we talk very readily about the post-traumatic, right? PTSD, post-traumatic stress syndrome, and about the aftermath of trauma, and about collective memories that rise up around traumatic events that are so severe that they can't really be fully registered in real time and have to be sort of belatedly processed. Yeah. But I started running across quotations like this from the urbanist Lewis Mumford, where he writes before the Second World War that the dweller in megalopolis, in what he calls the war capital, dies by anticipation 1,000 deaths. Fear is thus fixed into routine. The constant anxiety over war produces by itself a collective psychosis comparable to that which active warfare might develop. When you first encounter an idea like that, it seems kind of silly and deeply counterintuitive. But I began to read some of the memoirs of the Hibakusha, the survivors of the atomic bombings of Japan, of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And they too reported a kind of disturbing climate of anticipation that, while not as severely traumatizing as an actual raid, was nonetheless profoundly unsettling. And you begin to see similar kinds of folds in the temporality of trauma in the survivors of the bombing of Hamburg, for instance, who are simultaneously anticipating an event that they know is unprecedented, but also that that will come or must come, right? So these kinds of paradoxical temporal formations made me think this wasn't just about space, but also about the way time begins to move differently in respect to the bombings of civilian centers in the Second World, in the 20th century, the First and Second World Wars in particular, but not exclusively. Started reading in something that flared up briefly in the 80s called the nuclear criticism, which was a weird little side wing of deconstruction, but in which Jacques Derrida wrote about a total nuclear extinction event, leaving no aftermath in which to mourn, and therefore requiring that if a traumatic syndrome is to exist in respect to nuclear annihilation, it would need to exist in advance of the event. Susan Sontag had a similar thing to say about Japanese monster movies, that they sort of represent a kind of global traumatization around the existence of nuclear weapons. So there are all of these, you know, brief formulations about a kind of traumatizing anticipation, about how the expectation of violence can be a form of violence and can be a form of coercion, a form of political coercion as well. So now I want to just very quickly describe what I see as the sort of four main claims that this book is making, and then I will invite Eric and Sarah to join me up here. The first, I've talked a little bit about the temporal thread of this book, which proposes that indeed the anticipation of violence can inflict a kind of violence, whether it be a psychic violence, an interruption in industrial processes, an interruption in deliberative democratic processes, and go on to suggest that in the wake of the First World War, right, the first kind of major conflict in which, in the 20th century, in which cities are bombed from the air, there exists not only a post-traumatic stress syndrome around that memory, but also a pre-traumatic one in respect to a future war, which a lot of folks living in the interwar period felt was likely, and some felt was inevitable. And I'll come back to that interwar period in a little bit. I want to suggest that our trauma theory, to the extent that we still want to work within that paradigm, needs to be able to face not only toward the past, but also toward the future. Not so much in that hopeful way, necessarily, of producing a future in which violence is unimaginable, although there's nothing not to embrace about that. But in the sense that we need to think about how the perception of oncoming violence produces violent effects unto its on its own. And sort of in reference to that last point, I think it can be, it's tempting to say that unless the future seems open and unpredetermined, that we are morally and ethically and politically hampered and unfree. But one of the things that working on this book taught me was that there are times when certain forms of resistance, certain forms of refusal of the wrong kind of peace can actually come into a particularly clear focus when one feels that the future is indeed foreclosed or predetermined. And I wanted to take seriously that possibility that an open future is not the precondition of a resistant attitude toward one's political climate. I think I will just let these photographs of folks hover here without going too deeply into them, or I'll take up too much time. But these are some of the main figures that I touch on in the sort of pertinent chapters of this book. And Wolf really is the writer who, for me, especially late in her career, incarnates that that sort of imperative to think even more resistantly as the future appears to be a closed door. She writes some of her most radical refusals of the war and gender system, of the sort of view of women as compulsorily having to reproduce the next generation of soldiers for the war machine to consume, as the bombers, the German bombers, are flying over her house on the way to bomb London, especially in a piece called Thoughts on Peace in an Air Raid. Second thread, a spatial thread, which arises out of this expression total war, which is, as the subtitle of this book makes pretty clear, a really important hub. It's an expression that historians use all the time, but that actually seems to have been coined in 1916 in France by Léon Daudet, an Action Française writer, so a writer on the far right. And as that idea of total war gets elaborated in the years between the wars, it comes to mean a war of areas, not just fronts. So because of air power, it's not just, you know, the Western Front that is a site of violence, but areas behind the front and cities. That the distinction between combatants and non-combatants is essentially liquidated. And that the national war effort is imagined as fully mobilized. Every person, every institution, every space in a nation is imagined as dedicated to the waging of war. But what I was more surprised to learn was that during the interwar period, total war excluded certain kinds of conflict that one might have assumed that it would include, and that it really meant exclusively war between nation states, and particularly European nation states. And that what it left out was the kind of violence that was really ongoing through the 20s and 30s in mandates, protectorates, and colonies, right? Even as those spaces were hosting a kind of laboratory for what would become the techniques of the Second World War, the bombing of civilians, the destruction of civil infrastructure, and the like. So one of the key ideas in this book is that total war is always a partial concept. Partial not only because no war is ever actually fully total, but also partial in the sense that the idea of total war has ideological partialities, right? It leans toward certain kinds of warfare and wants to also deny other kinds of conflict the status of war and also the protection of international laws of warfare. So for instance, if you are an anti-colonial combatant, you are not protected by any kind of international law of warfare until the 1970s, right? You are not seen as participating in a kind of legal framework for conflict. And then the last point to make about this is that it's not just space, but race that is at stake in this, and that we can imagine a kind of concentrisms, a series of concentric circles of permissible violence radiating outward from the metropoles of Europe. And the farther out you go, the more violence during peacetime is permissible, right? So you can drop leaflets during general strikes in the north of England, you can drop bombs under certain conditions during the Troubles in Ireland, and you can bomb pretty much willy-nilly in the farther out mandates and protectorates, especially Iraq, then called Mesopotamia, which is a major site for this book. The second half of Tense Future is about literary form. You were probably wondering what happened to literature. And it's there, humming along throughout the first half of the book, but it becomes more of a forefront object in the second half, where I turn to a distinction that I'm trying to make between epic and encyclopedic literary forms. So what's this all about? Epic, the sort of standard view of epic versus the novel is that epic is a genre that belongs to sort of pre-modern societies that are small enough to be self-contained, to understand all of their working parts, and can produce, often in times of war, a kind of total portrait of that society. And that in modernity, epic is no longer possible because societies are too big and too heterogeneous and too fragmentary. And what I want to kind of claim, and this is another, I think, pretty counterintuitive claim in this book, is that far from being an outmoded form, epic becomes in some way the sort of master form of the world system of violence production in the 20th century, which I realize is a big claim. So what does that mean? Well, Hegel says about epic that societies can be apprehended in their totality, in their epic totalities, most clearly in times of war when a whole society is mobilized. And there's this idea that a society is most at one with itself in epic, in states of war. And as a way of trying to insist that a number of early 20th century works which are thinking about total war, but not wanting to accept it as the only way we have of thinking about how everything is connected to everything else, instead of trying to belatedly resuscitate the epic, turn toward another template for a large-scale, massively inclusive literary representation of a city or a society, and that is the encyclopedia. And that involved, oddly, going back into the 18th century and reading Diderot and D'Alembert and the French Encyclopedia, which it turns out isn't this kind of like, you know, isn't simply a weighty edifice of Enlightenment hubris, but is multi-voiced and profoundly self-contradictory and lumpy and perverse and ludicrous and ludic. It's a playful transnational space. And it was also a project that was undertaken with the understanding that disaster, whether human-made or natural, might befall the 18th century, and that they wanted to be ready to have sort of warehoused something like Enlightenment knowledge so that it could survive the next civilizational meltdown. So for this reason, and also because the Encyclopedia Britannica in the early 20th century, and here I want to give a shout out to Paul Statt, sitting up here, who lent me his 11th Britannica. the 11th Britannica was the encyclopedia prized by a number of the writers that I'm dealing with here, and it was famous for being full of eccentric points of view and eccentric writing styles, and not possessing a house style, not being this kind of homogenized space, but for being a work of deep heterogeneity. And what I want to then do, in reading a number of interwar long modernist works, is suggest that we misrecognize them if we think of them exclusively as somehow modern epics, right? And that the encyclopedia is a counter template, a counter portrait, if you will, of a society which is at risk of being seen as unified only through conflict. And that these books, even though none of them is really a war novel in any conventional sense, I'm not writing about All Quiet on the Western Front here, but about Ulysses and Parade's End and about Musil's Man Without Qualities to a lesser extent. These are books which are intimately thinking about modern warfare and about what it means to try to encompass a whole society while at the same time recognizing that that is an impossible project. And it's that co-presence of critique and doing it anyway that I find so inspiring about the encyclopedia and so generative in reading it in relation to these modernist blockbusters, these doorstops. And lastly, I wanted to talk briefly about the interwar period, which I said I was going to do. And this will, I hope, link up with some of Eric's interest in periods and periodizing literary histories. This book is proposing that we need to think about the interwar period in at least three ways. One is the retrospective one that we're used to, right? Which is the one that makes sort of the most intuitive sense. You don't know that an interwar period is interwar until the second war happens, right? So it has to be a retrospective period. So that you would say the interwar period lasted from November 11th, 1918 to September 1st, 1939. Okay, so we're familiar with that view. A second view would be to try to think about that period from the point of view of those who were living through it, many of whom, as I was suggesting earlier, experienced that period as it was unfolding, even in the late teens and early 20s, as an interwar period, right? They were waiting for the next conflict. They were waiting for the other shoe to drop, in other words. So that someone, we can imagine actually someone shouting on the 12th of November in 1918, the interwar period has just begun, right? Which sounds like a joke, but I want to suggest that we need to think about that period as it was lived out in relation to oncoming violence. And then finally, this one is maybe the strangest, to think about what about the 20s and 30s, what it is about the interwar period that maybe didn't end with the beginning of the Second World War. What would it mean to think about an interwar period that begins in 1918 and persists to the present day? That would be to transperiodize, in one way, this notion of an interwar period, and to think about a perpetual interwar. So, why this expression, which seems sort of, perversely, maybe willfully paradoxical? We're all used to hearing about perpetual peace, right, and to thinking about that as one of Kant's great cosmopolitan aspirations. Perpetual war is a phrase that we hear a lot by critics of contemporary warfare who say that war is always ongoing, even during peacetime, right? And who make lists of the small conflicts that don't rise to the level of warfare. And at this point, even our current president, President Obama, talks about wanting to end the perpetual war footing. And I think there is a truth to this notion of a perpetual war that we have been, in essence, waging, not just for the 20th century, but in different ways through the 19th century as well, right, which is supposed to be the Pax Victoriana. But I think that the critical edge of that notion of perpetual war has worn down a little bit, right? We've almost kind of become accustomed to it. And so in thinking about a perpetual interwar, I want to think about a couple of things. One is how, as I was suggesting about the 20s, right, for some people it's a time of peace, and for others it's a time of ongoing violence. And violence is not evenly distributed ever around the globe, but it's distributed with a particular unevenness during the interwar period, right, where you have supposed peacetime reigning in the sort of industrialized states, and a perennialized state of exception reigning in a lot of the rest of the world where violence is ongoing. So there's something about that uneven distribution of violence that it seems to me is useful to bring into our own moment, to think about how, you know, we might be sitting in this room in a time and a time zone that feels very much like peacetime, while our government is waging what looks very much to people on the ground in other parts of the world like war. And there's something about the interwar period that I think indexes that with a particular power. But I'm also thinking about interwar in Cicero's sense, right? He said, silent leges inter arma, for law falls silent in the midst of war. So inter can be not just between wars, but in the midst of conflict. And so a perpetual interwar would recognize that even in being between wars, we are in the midst of war. Or if we are not, someone else is. And a kind of insistence that we think about who else's experience of violence is underwriting our experience of the absence of violence. And the somewhat kind of paradoxical nature of that phrase, perpetual interwar, I think, helps jar us out of the settled notion of a perpetual peace or a perpetual war. And lastly, I would just observe that the interwar temporality, in a way, is the normative temporality of states, right, which want to reserve the right to go to war in the future and the right to claim the wars of the past as legitimate. So there's something about an interwar temporality that it seems to me is built into the sort of architecture of many contemporary states. There's the photograph, and this is one of those like share something that you regret you didn't know about in time things. This is a photograph of the Holland House during the Blitz in 1940. And I discovered very recently that it's actually a whole session, and that there's this version too, or this image too, which shows a woman holding a handbag wearing this amazing 1940 hat. And it's a very different kind of image. It doesn't suggest, you know, going infinitely toward a vanishing point, but somehow is to me more eloquent of the disordered room. The disordered and destroyed interior of that library, and interferes in a productive way with the sort of all-male trench-coated space that this photo limns. So I just wanted to share that with you as a kind of a little footnote to the cover image of this book.